I'd like to introduce Charles Efferson from the University of Lausanne. Charles started as a musician and literature student, then moved to biology, did his PhD at UC Davis on social learning, a topic actually also very relevant for us, did then a postdoc at Santa Fe and the University of Zurich, fully moved to the University of Zurich and moved then via Royal Holloway, now to the University of Lausanne. Now he is an economist at the University of Lausanne. That can happen, that from a musician over a biologist, you finally end up as a happy economist. He studies topics that are definitely relevant, not for for economics, but also for biology, as the evolution of cooperation, social norms. We discussed about bad traditions, harmful traditions, actually good and perhaps also good and bad traditions. Today it will be probably more about bad traditions. I'm looking forward to your talk.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for having me, and thank you for the introduction. Today's talk will, in some sense, yes, be about bad traditions, but more specifically, it will be about the potential to transition from a bad tradition to a good tradition, and in particular, the extent to which a policymaker can potentially recruit cultural evolutionary mechanisms to sort of spark or precipitate such a transition. Okay, so that's where we're headed. Very briefly before we do this, because I gather this is a quite interdisciplinary group, I thought I would spend a minute or two maximum giving a kind of primer as to what I see as the sort of overarching scientific framework for what we'll quickly transition to a very applied research talk. Okay, so the general framework, I think, can be thought of as what's often referred to as gene culture coevolutionary theory. So I start first with the genetic evolutionary part of this, and I'm going to think of it in very abstract terms. There's genetically coded information that's distributed in a population in some way, and this distribution changes through time because of mechanisms like natural selection, genetic drift, et cetera. Okay? That's fine. At a sufficient level of generality, we can think of a cultural analog of that. There's culturally encoded information in a population. We know very little, in my view, about what that actually means, but we assume that it occurs. Culturally encoded information in a population that's distributed in a population. And again, that distribution changes through time because of various mechanisms. Okay? The big difference here that I want to focus on is that cultural evolution can occur in particular because of systematic biases that structure how we learn from each other. Okay? So when people learn from others, they don't do it indiscriminately, rather they discriminate in some way. They pay attention to some people but not others, etc. And these kind of biases will drive cultural evolution at the aggregate level. However, what form that takes, well, the devil's in the details. It can take many different forms according to the biases that people actually exhibit. Okay? And then finally, the gene culture coevolution, which you can think of as linked evolutionary processes. So, for example, the genetic evolution of our social cognition structures how we learn from others, which drives cultural evolution, which can also reshape selection on genes. So you have linked evolutionary processes. The really sort of fascinating part of this link is cultural evolutionary processes reshaping selection on genes. There's some quite fascinating examples of this. I just wanted to talk very briefly about one of my favorites, and that's the evolution of cooking. So cooking is a culturally evolved process that's fine. But before we turn to the details, I want you to note the following. So for a primate of our size, humans have spectacularly small digestive tracts, right? We have tiny mouths with weak muscles, small stomachs, small large intestines, etc. Almost everything about our digestive tract is smaller than it should be. And in effect, in contemporary times, we are now locked into cooking. Here's an example of how this would work. So what I'm showing you here, some of you may know there's a contemporary movement called the raw foodist movement, where people think the more raw food they eat, the better. As it turns out, eating raw food is bad for people. So what we see here is the BMI, age-adjusted BMI, is a function of the proportion of the diet that consists of raw food. And you see the more raw food you eat, the skinnier you are. And these people are eating a lot of food. They're just not extracting a lot of energy from it. Even more sort of striking with respect to evolution, here we see the proportion of women who are not fertile as a function of the proportion of their diet that consists of raw food. And you can see that also rises dramatically. So there's a real fitness cost to consuming too much raw food. So in effect, we have this culturally evolved process, cooking, where we externalize digestion to some extent, right? Digestion doesn't begin in the mouth, it begins in the pot. And after a sufficient amount of time of this, it's created selection for an ever smaller digestive tract, and now we basically can't flourish without cooking. So that's a nice example of the feedback in both directions between genes and culture. Okay, so that's all by way of a sort of, if you like, grand theoretical backdrop. But today, I'm going to quickly turn now to applications of the cultural evolutionary part of this. So as it turns out, in let's say, development agencies and NGOs of various sorts, and it's also an academic undertaking to some extent, there's a lot of interest in the potential for a policymaker to recruit cultural evolutionary mechanisms to steer cultural evolution in a way that's consistent with policy objectives. Okay, so and the sort of generic or abstract idea here is, how can a policymaker do that to maximize cultural change with minimal intervention? So the basic notion is that you use cultural evolution to amplify the effects of an intervention, essentially. And a lot of the work gets done endogenously, if you like. Okay, so I'm going to focus on female genital cutting and sex-biased abortion as motivating examples of this idea. This is just because these are two domains that I've worked on a lot myself. But I would encourage you to think about the problem more broadly, because the basic ideas have been put forward in many domains. And here's just sort of a list. So foot binding, dueling, child marriage, open defecation, domestic violence, water conservation, obesity, alcohol consumption. In one way or another, all of these, to some extent, cultural practices have been identified as domains where these ideas might be appropriate. Okay? And as I said, the central task, what I'm going to focus on today, is how heterogeneity and frequency-dependent social learning strategies affects the potential for the policymaker to do this, to precipitate endogenous cultural change that's consistent with policy objectives. Whoops. And here's a sort of basic framework I'd like to keep you to keep in mind as the simple model, if you like, that informs a lot of programs that are attempting to do this in one way or another. So the basic idea is that at the individual level, social learners respond to information about the distribution of behaviors in a population in some way like that. So this is a kind of a typical social learning strategy. And as you'll see, it has this sigmoidal shape. So if a majority of people exhibit a given behavior, the individual social learner over-responds, if you like. They exhibit an exaggerated tendency to adopt that same behavior. If a minority adopts the behavior, then they over-respond in the other direction. Now, what this will do is, at the aggregate level, it will create path-dependent dynamics. Okay? So think of this as the proportion exhibiting a socially beneficial behavior in the population, if you like. So the idea here is that if a sufficiently large number of people initially exhibit the harmful behavior, then the tendency, then the proportion exhibiting this harmful behavior will get larger and larger until, in effect, everyone ultimately exhibits the harmful behavior. If, in contrast, you begin with a case in which a sufficient number of people exhibit the beneficial behavior, then the beneficial behavior will become more and more common until everyone exhibits the beneficial behavior. Okay? So there's an unstable steady state somewhere in the interior, often referred to as a tipping point. And the policymaker's objective is something like this. If this is the model you have in mind, when you come along and you observe a population exhibiting what you have decided is a harmful tradition, something like female genital cutting, if this is the model you have in mind, you tend to assume that they're stuck, so to speak, in this equilibrium in which approximately everyone is exhibiting the harmful behavior. Your task then, as a policymaker, is to shock the system somehow such that you push the population to the other side of this unstable equilibrium in the interior, at which point these endogenous social learning mechanisms switch from supporting the harmful behavior to supporting the beneficial behavior. In theory, at least, as a policymaker, you can pack your bags and move on to the next problem at that point, because these endogenous mechanisms will do the rest of the work for you. Okay?
If you go back to the previous slide. In this case, there is an assumption that the harmful behavior and the beneficial behavior, the externalities of both behaviors are similar in terms of the cooperation that would be there, or coordination that's there within the group, because everybody is following this bad or everybody is following this good behavior.
Yes. Yes, so in a simple version, yes, and any even additional assumption is that the population has homogeneous preferences, so everyone's essentially the same. This is exactly what I'm going to talk about a lot in the next few minutes, okay? But in any case, you'll notice that to the extent that this model is correct, there's a very clear prediction about what you should observe at the aggregate level, the kind of signature, in effect. Because the two stable equilibria in this system have, approximately speaking, everyone doing one behavior or another. So that implies that in a kind of a metapopulation, you expect the distribution of behaviors and attitudes to be distributed primarily between groups and not within groups. This is a pattern that Peyton Young, for example, has repeatedly referred to as local homogeneity and global heterogeneity, okay? So before we turn to FGC, for example, I want to ask, are there any examples of such a pattern, right? Can we find any good examples of this pattern holding, or is the whole idea silly, so to speak? Well, as it turns out, there are some quite spectacular examples of this pattern. This is also a study done several years ago by Young and Burke, so this is also Peyton Young. And what they did is they essentially looked at the distribution of sharecropping contracts in Illinois. So sharecropping is an institutional arrangement where you have a landowner who has land to farm, but he doesn't want to farm it, and then you have a farmer who's ready to farm but doesn't own any land. So they write a contract and they split the profits, or the corn, for example. Okay? Now, standard economic theory would predict that landowners have plots of that vary tremendously or vary continuously with respect to fertility. That would imply, if that's being incorporated in the negotiated sharecropping contracts, you would expect continuous variation in the proportion of the crop that goes to the farmer, for example, because farmers vary in terms of the value of the input they bring to the arrangement. As it turns out, you don't observe anything like that. In all of Illinois, you'll see this is roughly 1,000 farms, you basically see three contracts, a 50-50 split, a two-thirds, one-third split, and a three-fifths, two-fifths split. And the reason seems to be, approximately speaking, that they're not really negotiating. There's a strong normative component to this exchange, whereby a very small number of contracts are considered acceptable or fair, if you like. That's what people choose, and they don't negotiate more broadly. So this is a very clear example of what you would call local homogeneity, right? Something about the cultural evolutionary process has compressed the observed behaviors more than what you would expect. Okay? Here's an example of the overall pattern that I find quite interesting, this of global heterogeneity, local homogeneity. And this is from Switzerland, and here's the story. So conditional on becoming unemployed in Switzerland, people who become unemployed in the French-speaking part of Switzerland are on average unemployed 7 weeks longer than people who become unemployed in the German-speaking part of Switzerland. Okay? Now, if that's all you knew, you wouldn't know if there's any cultural effect there, and for example, culturally evolved preferences for leisure. But what they showed in this study, quite striking, is that it's not a continuous gradient that captures the variation here. In fact, rather, it's a sharp discontinuity that occurs right at the language border. To drive the point home, this continuity exists even if you limit attention to the three cantons in Switzerland where the language border goes down the middle of the canton. So everything is institutionally equivalent, and by extension, incentives are equivalent, but there's still this sharp discontinuity. They interpret this as cultural variation and preferences for leisure, if you like. But sort of more to the point, for today's purposes, you'll see very clearly it exhibits this postulated pattern, local homogeneity, global heterogeneity. Okay? So that's all by way of saying there are good empirical examples of this pattern. And by extension, we can sort of, to some extent, assume that something about the cultural evolutionary processes in these cases are generating this aggregate pattern. So there is something to the idea. Now, what about the domains where the idea is applied from a policy perspective? Okay, so let's first talk about female genital cutting. This is something I've worked on quite a bit through the years in Sudan. I'll skip most of the details, but I just want to point out a couple of key points. So if you work on female genital cutting, the traditional way of collecting data is the following. You basically sort of drive your UNICEF pickup or whatever it is into the local village. You pull out your clipboard and you say, do you favor cutting? Did you cut your daughter? Do you think it's a good practice? Do you plan to continue doing it? You ask 6 questions or whatever, and then you go to the next household. Okay, this is fine, but this kind of procedure for collecting data, the concern is that it's highly susceptible to social desirability bias, right? To the extent that respondents know that the correct answer, so to speak, is no, I would never do such a terrible thing, they may say that they don't support cutting, even if they really do. So to avoid that problem, we went to, I would say, rather extreme lengths to develop new, robust methods for collecting data on attitudes and behaviors related to cutting in Sudan. Again, I'll skip most of the details, but just to highlight a couple of key innovations. One of the ways we developed for estimating cutting rates at the community level is we designed a program that exploits the fact that girls have henna applied to their feet on the day they're cut. And this is the only circumstance under which a young girl would have henna applied to her feet in that area. So the henna wears off the skin pretty quickly, but it does not wear off the toenail. So the entire toenail has to grow out before you can't see it. So you have a window of roughly 8 weeks in which if you see henna on the toenail, you know that girl was recently cut. So anyway, we exploited this to design a new method for estimating cutting rates at the community level. This was a paper we published in 2015 where we combined these kinds of data with other sources of data, and we estimated the cutting rates in 45 communities in the state of Jazeera in Sudan. So again, remember, if this model that informs so much policy holds, you would expect the data to look something like this, right? You would have a set of communities where basically no one cuts, and you would have a set of communities where roughly everyone cuts. As it turns out, it's exactly the opposite. Most communities consist of a mixture of cutting and non-cutting families. And just by way of caution, these communities tend to be quite tightly integrated. They're highly, I forget the word, but in any case, most people marry within the community. So in that sense, it's especially striking that, in effect, cutting families and non-cutting families are neighbors, if you like. We also designed an implicit association test to sort of survey implicit attitudes about cut versus uncut girls. And we administered that with adults in the same 45 communities. One point to make is that estimated cutting rates using our henna-feet method are highly correlated in the right direction with average IET scores, okay? So that's striking in the sense that the cutting rates are estimated effectively by photographing the feet of girls. The average IET scores are estimated by randomly sampling adults and administering the IET. There's no connection between these data points except the fact that all these people live in the same community. We don't necessarily know that these adults are the parents of these girls. They may be in some cases, but we don't know that. Okay? In any case, you would also potentially expect, if this traditional model that informs policy to hold, you would expect attitudes to diverge to some extent. You would expect to see a sort of mode of people who are in favor of cutting and a mode of people who are opposed to cutting. So when you plot IET scores, you would expect to see a kind of a bimodal distribution. That's a function of the fact that a zero score has real meaning, right? It's not an arbitrary scale. So you would expect a negative mode and a positive mode. Well, as you see, you don't see anything like that. There's a lot of variation, but it's not bimodal. There's no evidence whatsoever of two distinct sets of attitudes. That's true if you look over all 45 communities. It's also true if you look at each of the communities separately. Okay? And we also have a lot of data from Sudan that's not yet published. We've now, for example, repeated this henna-feet exercise in, I think this is 149 communities. And you'll see the same basic pattern. The typical scenario is that a community consists of a mixture of cutting families and non-cutting families. So if you like local heterogeneity, which is not really consistent with the aggregate prediction of the model. Now, that's especially striking because we have other data from Sudan that shows it's not that people don't care about conformity. At the individual level, they do value conforming locally. However, for some reason, at the aggregate level, it's not producing the predicted pattern, local homogeneity, global heterogeneity. Okay, and that's going to be the point of departure for the models I turn to in a second. Also, before I leave female genital cutting, I'd like to point out there's been a flurry of empirical studies on FGC from many countries in Africa the last 5 years or so. And in effect, all of them, so they've used very different types of data, very different types of analysis, but in effect, all of them have found a pattern of this sort. There's lots of local heterogeneity in attitudes and behaviors related to cutting. This is striking because, as I said, one of the things I forgot to point out, this model is the dominant model informing interventions trying to get families to abandon female genital cutting. Just to illustrate, I tried to calculate how much money has been spent on this model in this window of time here. It's not easy to do, but I was able to determine at bare minimum, this is a really conservative estimate, it was at least $90 million. Okay, you had a question?
Yeah, I was just wondering whether you've got, this is really interesting results, whether you've got any information about more fine scales of social network attributes in these populations, whether indeed there is some sort of structure that's not found in this geographic location, but maybe found in, say, a network of directly interacts.
Yes, so the short answer is no, and that's exactly what we would need. The next step is really good network data. However, we did make a kind of a crude attempt to understand, because FGC and the incentives to conform or coordinate, the argument largely revolves around marriageability. So the concern is that if you do not follow the local practice, your daughter will not be marriageable effectively, and that's a really serious problem in these communities. Okay, so what I can tell you is that the geographically defined village is the marriage pool. Okay, so it doesn't exclude the possibility that every village is fragmented into two separate marriage pools. But I think that's so. I'm not going to categorically say that's wrong, but I think it's extremely unlikely. Actually, many of these are small villages, right? A few hundred people. It would be quite a trick for them to all be divided into two separate marriage pools, one of which has a cutting norm, the other of which has a non-cutting norm. But to get to your real point, you're absolutely right. What we ultimately need is good network data, I think. Yep. Yes?
Is your test not biased in the direction of no cutting? Because when the header is grown out of the male, it looks like it was not cut?
Yeah. It's possible, but the henna is not the only source of data we used. We actually created various indices using other kinds of data collected by medical doctors. So I can't tell you for sure, no. But in any case, every way we did it, every way we coded cut versus non-cut, yes, there's a level effect, which you would expect. There's never any kind of discontinuity. It's the discontinuity that would be more telling, I think. So what about son preference in our media? This is the other domain where I've been doing field work. And you may or may not know, but in Armenia, families preferentially abort female fetuses. And this has created some highly skewed sex ratios at birth. Okay, this is another domain in which policymakers, in particular UNICEF and the UNFPA, have had this kind of path-dependent dynamics model in mind, with the associated assumption that if they can shock a population, they can tip it from a harmful tradition to a beneficial tradition. Okay, so we started working in Armenia about 6 years ago. It's a bit of a more of an exploratory study, if you like, because this sex-biased abortion in Armenia was only discovered about 9 years ago. So it's a relatively recent phenomenon that people realized it was happening, at least in terms of scientific research. So we went into it thinking, again, because the conventional wisdom in Armenia is that there's a lot of regional variation, right? The regions vary markedly in terms of their preference for sons, and that will generate regional variation in sex-biased abortion. And that would be consistent with the notion, at least, of global heterogeneity, local homogeneity. Okay? So here I'm showing you sex ratios at birth from our data set, conditional on what happens at given points. Okay? And I want to draw, and these are three different regions within Armenia. The conventional wisdom among Armenians is that Gerhard Kunik has the strongest son bias. So this is where you're going to get the most sex-biased abortion. And Sunik is basically free of sex bias. So there's very little sex-biased abortion going on in Sunik. However, we elicited full reproductive histories with a kind of an anonymous self-administered questionnaire. I can talk more about that later if interested. But one of the things that allowed us to do is to look at specific kinds of sex ratio at birth. And the one I want you to especially focus on are these red dots here. So these red dots here are sex ratios at birth for the third child in a family, conditional on the first two children being girls, okay? So this is a situation when if there is a latent preference for sons, it should really bite, right? These are people who are saying, we've already got two kids, we don't have a son, we have a problem and we need to fix it, okay? So if you look at specifically, you focus on that. One thing I want to point out is you'll notice all three regions are the same. You have extreme sex ratios at birth, and there's no evidence of any difference between the three regions. And I just want to point out, right, how incredible these numbers are. It's on the order of 400 boys for every 100 girls. That can only happen, obviously, if you have a lot of sex-biased abortion. Okay, so that sort of argues against global heterogeneity. It argues against that part of the pattern. We also developed two IETs here, and we were able to, we put a huge amount of effort into validating both of these IETs. This worked even considerably better than in Sudan. I'll skip those details, but what I want to show you here is we administered the IET for the three individuals within a household who are considered the key decision makers, the wife, the husband, and the husband's mother. Okay? And we did that in about 900 households around Armenia. And what you'll see is that the really notable source of variation is husbands, right? Husbands are the one with the anomalous preferences. This was especially surprising because, again, the conventional wisdom in Armenia is that husbands and their mothers had aligned preferences. They were both focused on sons. Well, it turns out it's the husbands who have the anomalous preferences. The other thing that I want to point out here again, of course, is that this is the most local form of heterogeneity possible. It's heterogeneity within the household. So again, to some extent, we have a very different pattern than what's predicted from the path-dependent dynamic model, where you expect local homogeneity, global heterogeneity. Okay? So to sort of summarize, that's all by way of, let's say, empirical background. So for the last couple of years, I've been sort of puzzling through this problem, trying to think, well, we know that people in general exhibit some tendency to conform, right? There's huge amounts of evidence showing that conformity is an important decision-making mechanism of some kind. We also know in Sudan in particular that when it comes, and not just Sudan, many countries, there are data showing that when it comes to a family's decision to cut their daughters or not, that people, families do care about local conformity, okay? So at the individual level, the mechanism does matter. We have a lot of support for that idea. It does matter, but it's not generating the aggregate pattern we expect, local homogeneity, global heterogeneity. And that's especially important from a policy perspective because remember, if this model with the tipping point holds, we should expect to see that pattern. So to the extent that the pattern is not there, you can at least question whether the assumed potential for a policymaker to trigger endogenous cultural change is also, if that also obtains. So to sort of make some headway on this, I developed a set of models where I said, okay, let's assume people care about conformity in one way or another, but they're heterogeneous in other ways. Okay, so I'm going to add various forms of heterogeneity to the model, and I'm going to ask, to what extent does this affect the ability of the policymaker to trigger this endogenous cultural change? Okay, so that's going to be the key mix. Now, in terms of the heterogeneity, we also have quite a bit of evidence for this, right? There's been a flurry of experimental studies on social learning strategies and cultural transmission for the last 10 years or so. There are a lot of experimental paradigms. It's still a bit of a mess in some sense, at least in my view. But there's been one big conclusion to come out of this, and that's that social learning strategies are extremely heterogeneous. People do not respond to social information in the same way. Okay? And in particular, we know the little bit of theory that's been done on this suggests that this kind of heterogeneity should have a very profound effect on the dynamics at the aggregate level. So it's not just a kind of a trivial question. It should actually affect aggregate dynamics quite dramatically. Okay? And it should have associated consequences for the policymaker interested in applied cultural evolution. So in my case, I'm going to take conformity as a kind of a baseline psychological tendency at the individual level, and I'm going to mix it with heterogeneous preferences, heterogeneity in the response to a policymaker's intervention, heterogeneous social networks, and a heterogeneous emphasis on distinguishing your own group from some outgroup. I'll explain more about these as I go through, but just kind of as a map of where we're going. Okay, now before we get to the models proper, I want to spend a moment sort of cultivating intuition about how individual heterogeneity and social learning matters, how it affects aggregate dynamics, and how it can be important for a policymaker. And I'm going to focus on variation and sensitivity to frequency-dependent social information. So in other words, to what extent do people respond to how common or rare different behaviors are, okay? So this is an early experimental study I did several years ago. It was basically a study to see to what extent people are conformist, to what extent they tend to follow the majority, if you like. I'll skip most of the details here, but this D estimate, so conformity is increasing in intensity as you move in this direction to the right, okay? And these were incentivized choices, so there was real money on the table. And each dot here is an individual social learner, right? So what you'll see quite clearly, the experimental design, the experimental paradigm was such that the incentives favored conformity. So to the greater, the more you conformed, the more money you made in this experiment. You'll see that here as a positive correlation between the intensity of conformity and the amount of money the subject made. But what I want to focus on is, of course, there's spectacular heterogeneity, right? There are a lot of people who are conforming less than the maximum possible amount, and they are leaving money on the table as a result, okay? So here's another study that sort of approaches heterogeneity and conformity from the opposite direction. So this was a study done by Hure and Yariv. And in this study, conformity was bad, okay? So to the extent that you conformed as an individual, you lost money and they're using their paradigm. Still, you'll see tremendous heterogeneity in the tendency to conform in their data set. So these are individuals who basically always conformed, and they paid dearly for that preference, and some individuals never conformed. Again, though, lots of heterogeneity in the tendency to conform. Okay, so why would this matter? Here's a very simple model of why this might matter for a policymaker. Okay, so I'm going to assume two basic types of conformists. One that's relatively responsive. So here's, I'm going to frame this in terms of not cutting, right? So here's the individual level social learning strategy, right? So this is the probability that a focal family or a focal decision maker chooses not to cut as a function of the proportion not cutting in the population, okay? And I'm going to assume, simple case, two different types of social learners. One type is relatively responsive to social information, so they exhibit this strategy here. It has the sigmoidal shape necessary for path-dependent dynamics. And then you have another type that also exhibits the sigmoidal shape, but they're less responsive. So they're just less sensitive to the social information. Okay? So as a thought exercise, I'm going to imagine what happens as the distribution over these two types shifts in favor of the less responsive type. Okay? So that's what's happening here. The less responsive type of social learner is becoming more and more common in the population. And this is simply a bifurcation diagram that shows you the equilibria of the system as a function of the distribution over these two types. So the solid lines are stable equilibria. The dashed line is an unstable equilibria, or a tipping point, if you like. Okay, so you'll see whenever the entire population consists of the more responsive types, right, you have two equilibria at the extremes. So a policymaker who finds a harmful tradition here needs to shock the population such that it crosses the tipping point, and the maximum possible endogenous cultural change is shown in purple here. So this is the part that, in theory, the policymaker doesn't need to do that. Endogenous mechanisms will take care of that part of the transition, okay? But as you increase the proportion in the population composed of this less responsive type, you'll notice that these two stable equilibria converge on the interior. The potential to activate spillovers, and what I mean by that is a transition, an endogenous transition towards the socially beneficial behavior, the potential to activate spillovers gets smaller and smaller until it disappears altogether. Okay, so this is just a very simple way of demonstrating that the structure of the heterogeneity in social learning strategies can control the extent to which the policymaker can rely on this mechanism.
Mm-hmm. Just a quick question about the model here. Is it really social learning, or does the model just have social influence?
Yeah, you're right. In the simple case, it's better to just refer to this as some blind response to frequency dependent.
Because it could also be that individuals actually do learn to be more.
Yes.
I could reinforce this even further to some different domains, for example. Because in many cases in these models, people are talking about social influence, but they call it learning even though there's no learning. So I just wanted to clarify here, because I think learning itself could be an additional component that would be of interest.
So in a sense, I'm going to be completely agnostic about this point. I'm just saying, imagine two strategies of this sort.
So here it's social influence, not social learning.
Well, it depends on who you talk to, right? If you talk to someone like Joe Henrich or Rob Boyd, they're going to tell you that the reason strategies of this sort evolve is because they aggregate over noise experienced at the individual level. So in that sense, it is a kind of a social learning. If you talk to a social psychologist, they might just refer to a phrase like social influence.
But in what world is no learning?
Here, there's nothing more than this. In this simple case, I'm just positing a phenomenological description of these two strategies, and that's it. I have nothing more to say about it, actually. So now let's get to sort of the models proper that sort of combine these different mechanisms. And I'm going to start with a model that assumes everyone is a strong conformist. I'll explain what that means in a second. But they have heterogeneous preferences, okay? So when I say everyone is a strong conformist, I mean that they exhibit these frequency-dependent strategies, but they're strong conformists in the sense that their choices at the individual level are deterministic, right? So here's one individual. And you'll see, in this case, they're conformists in the sense that if there's a sufficiently large, or let's say, if the proportion of the agents in the population exhibiting the beneficial behavior is sufficiently low, then the individual adopts the harmful behavior with certainty, okay? But if the proportion of agents in the population adopting the beneficial behavior is sufficiently high, they adopt the beneficial behavior with certainty, okay? And there's a transition at some point here, okay? So in that sense, everyone is a strong conformist. They adopt one of the two behaviors with certainty. They have heterogeneous preferences in the sense that the threshold that leads them to switch from one behavior to the other varies at the individual level, okay? So this is a person who has a preference favoring the beneficial behavior, so not cutting, for example. For that reason, they have a really low threshold. If only 10% of the population abandons cutting, this individual is also ready to abandon cutting, okay? Here's someone who's also sort of inclined to abandon cutting, but they have a bit of a weaker preference in that direction than this individual. So here are four individuals just to illustrate. And here's someone at the other extreme who, for whatever reason, places an intrinsic value on cutting. So again, they're conformists. They will respond to changes in the distribution of cutting and non-cutting, but they require a much higher threshold before they abandon cutting, okay? So that's what I mean by individual heterogeneity coupled with strong conformity, okay? So you can show in this case that the distribution of thresholds translates into cultural evolutionary dynamics according to the cumulative distribution function, right? So here's a density over thresholds, here's the associated cumulative distribution function, and what you can show is that if you have a scenario that looks like this, you do in fact have a tipping point where you have stable equilibria at the two boundaries, okay? If you have a distribution that looks like this, it's exactly the opposite, right? In this case, the only stable equilibrium is in the middle. So here you would get local heterogeneity, global homogeneity. It depends on the structure of the heterogeneity, essentially, okay? So that's sort of background. Now I'm gonna add a number of things to this model that we know in one way or another are empirically relevant with respect to things like FGC. Before we get to that, I want to just point out, in all cases, I'm going to normalize the spillover in the following way. And I'm imagining the following scenario. So a policymaker comes along and implements some intervention, okay? So think of this as a program promoting the abandonment of female genital cutting, okay? Now the question then is, what happens after that intervention? If additional people then abandon the harmful practice, we can think of that as a positive spillover, okay? If the proportion exhibiting the harmful behavior then increases again relative to the intervention, we can think of that as a negative spillover, okay? I'm gonna standardize these changes because I'm gonna consider interventions of different sizes. So to sort of normalize the spillover, I'm gonna map this interval here, whatever it is, to 0, 1, and I'm going to map this interval here, whatever it is, to negative 1, 0, okay? I'm going to average spillovers, normalize spillovers over simulations in most cases, although not always, and I'm going to focus on positive spillovers, all right? So I'm going to begin with a model that does the following. It begins with this threshold model I just showed you. And so I'm going to assume that preferences with respect to cutting vary, as I just explained. All agents exposed to an intervention respond with a change in preferences. So the individuals directly targeted by an intervention, for the moment at least, I'm going to assume they have a shift in preferences such that their threshold goes to zero. So those individuals adopt the beneficial behavior unconditionally. Okay? I'll change that later, but that's where I'm going to begin. And everyone's fully connected also to begin. Okay? So given this framework, the policymaker has two decisions to make. Namely, how big of an intervention should the policymaker implement? So what proportion of the population should the policymaker target? And which segment of the population to target? Okay, and I'm going to consider three possibilities here. An amenable target, so these are the people with the lowest thresholds in the population. A resistant target, so those are the segment of the population with the highest thresholds. And then a random target that's selected without regard for pre-existing thresholds. So I'm going to consider those three targets for the intervention. Okay. Now what you can show, given this framework, you can show this analytically, in fact, is that a random target cannot be worse than an amenable target, and it will typically be strictly better. Similarly, a resistant target cannot be worse than a random target in terms of generating spillovers, and it will typically be strictly better. Now, this is a kind of a fundamental point with respect to policy, because there's a strong culture in organizations like UNICEF or the UNFPA, for example, to target individuals who are amenable to your message, right? Who want to work with you. That is effectively the best way to minimize spillovers, if that's your strategy. Okay, and the intuition is clear, right? If you target amenable agents who have the lowest pre-existing thresholds, then you only affect the cumulative distribution function down here, right? But you need to affect the cumulative distribution function up here to generate subsequent endogenous change. To put it more intuitively, if you target amenable agents, you take the easiest possible task for your intervention, and you leave the hardest possible task for subsequent endogenous effects. And that's exactly why it minimizes spillovers. If you take a random target, you attenuate this problem because you leave some amenable people out. And if you target a resistant, the resistant segment of the population, you attenuate it even further. Okay? So anyway, that's one result. And you see the same effect with simulations. I'm going to show you a few graphs of this sort, so I want to take a minute just to explain how they work. So I want to focus only on panel A here, and the different squares are effectively the decision space of the policymaker, right? So I consider interventions of different sizes, ranging from 10% of the population all the way up to 50% of the population, and then three different types of targets, amenable, random, and resistant, okay? Within each square, I consider 121 different distributions of initial threshold values or pre-existing threshold values, okay? So I'll just show you what they look like here. So these are the 121 threshold distributions I consider. This is basically what you see within each of these squares in the graph here. So in particular, above the 45-degree line, you have right-skewed distributions. So this is a scenario that's relatively favorable to spillovers. Below the 45-degree line, you have a left-skewed distribution. So this is a situation that's relatively unfavorable. And then along the 45-degree line, it's not skewed, period. Okay? So the color, the intensity of the color represents the size of the normalized distribution, okay? So where you see a lot of color, you have a lot of spillovers. I'm sorry, the normalized spillover. So when you see a lot of color, you see a lot of spillover. White basically means an absence of spillovers. And what you'll see here is if you look, especially for large interventions, you'll see that as you go from an amenable to a resistant target, the range of conditions under which a policymaker can generate endogenous spillovers increases. That's a simulation version of what I just showed you. So that's, you see the effect here. But also notable about this is you'll also see that the pre-existing distribution of preferences has a really dominant effect on the outcome, right? In other words, what the policymaker can't do anything about, right? That's taken as given for the policymaker. It has a huge effect on what the policymaker can and cannot expect to accomplish in terms of spillovers, okay? So next subtlety we're going to add is we're going to assume that people are heterogeneous in terms of how they respond to the intervention. In particular, people who are initially relatively favorable towards cutting are less likely to respond to the intervention. That's the basic assumption, okay? Now, as part of our work in Sudan, we did a large field experiment where we found exactly this pattern. We found that people initially, the people who were initially most in favor of cutting responded, were least likely to respond to the intervention, et cetera. So it's just kind of an empirical support for that assumption. Well, as it turns out, this, perhaps unsurprisingly, destroys many of the advantages of a resistant target in terms of generating spillovers. And I'm going to go straight to this graph to show this result. So this is the same thing, except I've now added this heterogeneous response to the intervention. And if you look down here, for example, you'll see that you lose all of the spillovers in this region here, right? You lose the gains of targeting a resistant segment of the population. Perhaps even more strikingly, under the assumptions in this model, you'll see, in effect, nothing, the policymaker's decisions don't matter, actually. There's nothing the policymaker can do to affect spillovers in this case. This does not mean that the policymaker can't affect behavior change, right? A large intervention is presumably going to convince more people than a small one. But with respect to the specific question of what can the policymaker do to shape the magnitude of spillovers, at least for this model, you see that this problem can be surprisingly beyond the grasp of the policymaker. You can also, we also added homophily. And what I mean by this is that people who had relatively similar preferences before the intervention were more likely to be linked. Okay, so in that sense, it controls how who's connected to whom and how information diffuses through the network. So here's a graph with weak homophily and strong homophily, and you get the impression that overall, homophily can have a pretty devastating effect on spillovers. However, as it turns out, the effects of homophily are not monotonic. So to show that, what we did is we took one symmetric distribution right about here, and we varied homophily continuously, okay? So we picked a distribution here because that's the kind of distribution of threshold values where other mechanisms should have a particularly strong effect. So if you do that, you'll get a picture like this. So what I'm showing you here, homophily is increasing on the horizontal axis and the spillover is shown on the vertical axis. And then I have interventions of various sizes, 10%, 20, up to 50, okay? And what I'd like you to focus on, look for example here, an intervention that targets 10% of the population. This is where you see it, the effects of homophily are not monotonic, right? You get larger spillovers under any degree of homophily than you do a case where there's no homophily at all, okay? But this is mainly relevant for small interventions. More broadly, you'll see that the overall pattern is that as homophily increases, spillovers go down, okay? Now, given a particular degree of homophily, you'll see in particular that a random target generates much larger spillovers than either an amenable or a resistant target. And the idea there is that a random target means you're basically seeding any of the fragments in the population with some degree of behavior change. If you add a heterogeneous response to the intervention, you get the same pattern, but spillovers go sort of depressingly down. They go down quite a bit. And then last couple of minutes that we did one other model that focused on the that was inspired by the following story. So in Kenya in the 1950s, there was a group of local political leaders who were seen as the kind of pawn of local colonizers, and they decided that they were going to ban female genital cutting in the local area. And this ban was in place for 3 years. Any family that violated the ban was fined quite heavily. Okay? So as a kind of counter reaction to this ban, a number of girls decided to start cutting themselves. So they would buy razor blades and they would go out into the bush and they would cut themselves. In effect, presumably the reasons were complicated, but if you read the ethnography here, at least part of the reason was an assertion of cultural identity and cultural autonomy in the face of what they saw as an outside influence threatening their cultural identity and sets. So they wanted to sort of take the outside culture as an example of how not to behave. And they were willing to cut themselves, in effect, to do that. So we did a second model, another model where we basically said, okay, in addition to a desire to conform to the in-group, the sort of standard mechanism that's behind the policy interventions, people also, to some extent, have an interest in distinguishing their group from the out-group, okay, to kind of maintain the cultural identity or the cultural boundary between their group and the out-group. So that's the basic mechanism here. And what we found is that this can have a quite devastating effect on spillovers. So as you move in this direction, the focus on differentiating your group from the out-group is increasingly strong, okay? And these, again, are interventions from 10% up to 50%. And as you can see, as this focus on maintaining your group's cultural identity increases, the potential to activate spillovers go down. However, somewhat surprisingly, again, it's not monotonic. If in-group conformity tends to be really strong, so what I mean by that is conditional on conforming to the in-group, you really do it seriously, right? You exhibit a really exaggerated tendency to follow the majority behavior. If that's true, then this focus on out-group differentiation or maintaining your own group's identity can actually, under very limited circumstances, actually improve conditions for spillovers. And the idea here is that if you have really strong in-group conformity and a policymaker implements a relatively small intervention, which is what we're looking at here, it's not enough to overcome in-group conformity, right? It's not enough of a shock. So as soon as the policymaker leaves, in-group conformity kicks in and moves you back towards the harmful equilibrium, okay? But when you mix in a little bit of this out-group differentiation, it's an extra source of noise in decision-making, and it effectively increases the probability that you escape, that the population escapes the basin of attraction for this harmful equilibrium. But it only occurs under these restricted circumstances. In-group conformity is really strong, and the policymaker is implementing a small intervention. Okay? So to wrap up, spillovers, and by extension, the potential of applied cultural evolution can range in some sense from the trivial to the spectacular. So this generic notion that you can move in, shock a system, and expect these spillovers to take over, it's not generally applicable. It's a harder question, unfortunately. In particular, the interaction between conformity and heterogeneity in social learning is a key mechanism. Given the range of models we analyzed, I'm happy to say that they all suggest that a random target is the most robust approach to precipitating spillovers, especially noteworthy given that the evidence we have indicates that development organizations have a pretty strong tendency to target amenable individuals, actually, which is the worst way to generate spillovers, actually. Okay? And if there's this sort of group identity mechanism in place, it can be critical to destabilize any link between the harmful practice or the harmful tradition and group identity. Okay? Otherwise, that also, what effectively the identity mechanism does is it adds value, it adds intrinsic value to the harmful practice, and this can limit the potential for spillovers. Okay? So thank you very much.
So thank you for the presentation. It was very interesting. You talk about spillovers in terms of how the norm can change within, but even though those people are not really treated, that's it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But is there any research on what are the losses during the transition? So have other aspects to it as well. So if a population follows a norm, there could be other coordination benefits that a norm can lead to. For example, in FGC, the marriage market is another thing that gets affected due to FGC.
Mm-hmm.
So when people start changing this norm from not current to current to not current, what are the other losses that may lead to during this transition period for the population, if there is a policy to
Well, I mean, I guess your question, in a sense, goes to the heart of the issue. It's not clear to what extent there is a norm, actually. I mean, when I show you that the typical scenario in a Sudanese village is that, you know, 40% cut and 60% don't, or 60% cut and 40% don't, one has to ask, if there's a norm there, what would it be? It's not obvious. The model upon which many interventions are based basically predicts that this situation when there's a mix will be very unstable for a variety of reasons, and that if a transition, once a transition occurs, it will go very, very fast. That's the basic prediction. So, well, in a sense, I don't know how to answer your question, but it captures the paradox of why is there a mix anyway? Why are people willing to tolerate that? And I don't think we have an answer to that, actually.
Well, so my question is about what you were showing, the difference between targeting amicable versus their resistance
yep.
to random individuals.
Yep.
And so you were showing that in like the perfect world, if you could switch a huge number of resistant individuals, it works very well. In terms of reality, where maybe you have to kind of choose, you might have a different intervention to target resistant individuals versus amicable individuals. And
yep.
maybe it's like higher cost, and if you're a number of resistant versus a lot
yep.
of amicable.
Yeah.
Have you looked at what kind of the trade-off there is, like in terms of how many resistant individuals we have to flip such that you start getting kind of the useful extreme effects you're seeing?
Yeah, so there are a couple of things to say here. One is, of course, I've ignored the cost of convincing a resistant person versus an amenable. So that's a kind of an indirect way of considering the cost. But you're right, there's a trade-off. If you target, I mean, the intuition, I think, makes it clearest. If you target amenable people, they're easiest to convince via the direct effect of the intervention, but you've left the hardest task for the subsequent endogenous change. If you target resistant people, it's the opposite problem. Hardest to convince, but you've left the easiest task for subsequent endogenous change. There's a trade-off there that I think empirically, for example, we know little about. All I can tell you is the overall picture, given the models I've done, says that the most robust approach is a random target. But again, I've made a number of assumptions. I've made a functional assumption about how the probability of responding to the intervention declines. If it was different from that, you'd get a different result in terms of the details somehow. So I think the only thing to say is, yes, there's a trade-off. We don't really understand much about how it works. The point I want to make is that if you're counting on spillovers, an amenable target is a bad strategy.
So we've done work that seems at least to be quite similar to this, where we've looked at sort of extremism in populations and decision making and how to influence populations when there are opposing views.
Yeah.
And what we found is that actually targeting the unbiased individuals, so not random individuals,
mm-hmm.
but actually those individuals towards the middle of your distribution, they're the ones that can allow the population to readily flip
mm-hmm.
In whichever direction one wants.
So yes.
I wondered whether you'd tried that as well, because you tried the randoms anywhere in the distribution,
mm-hmm.
but did you try just selecting individuals from that middle part of the distribution, i.e. not the two parts,
yeah.
not the resistant, not the amenable, but the other?
Yeah, yeah. So take the sort of middle core to get the proportion you need. No, actually, no.
And the interesting thing about that is it seems to be consistent with what you're describing, because if the social response function at the individual level becomes very nonlinear,
yeah.
then in actual fact this no longer works. You actually have to have a relatively shallow nonlinearity in the response function, which seems to be consistent with some of your other results. And that's also what we find within animal groups as well.
Okay. Okay, that's interesting. No, we haven't done that. Thank you. Thanks.